Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Don and Dude.
I crash you. I'm crashing your head. Crash. Crash.
remember that from Kids in the Hall?
I do. Yes, I still do that on occasion.
This is the Album Nerds Podcast. I'm Dude. I got Don with me. So this week we are crushing on some albums. How's your heart feeling after all this romance?
TikTok, you don't stop.
TikTok, you don't stop. Classic. And that's what we'll be getting into today. Of course, we're the Album Nerds. We love albums and the album format. Talking about them, thinking about them, loving them, crushing on them occasionally. Mm-hmm. We have a great show for you today. That's what we'll be doing this week. We'll be talking about two albums that we had secret crushes on. You know, albums that maybe we didn't want to tell our friends about, but we enjoyed anyway. As always, Don's going to be asking us a deep question. Then we'll have some shout-outs to some other albums and album-related items we're digging. And then we'll get into the details of what we're doing next week. Hint, hint, it's spooky. But this week, it's all about the secret album crushes.
I think I have a crush.
That's what I'm talking about!
Secret crushes are those records people love to play in private, but rarely admit enjoying. Each person's secret crush tells a story about personal taste and musical comfort. And today, we will explore albums we keep to ourselves, yet revisit for honest enjoyment, no matter how uncool they might seem.
Yeah, and also, sometimes it just falls out of favor really quickly. Mm-hmm. Like, something was super cool, and then, especially in your youth, tastes just change so fast.
Yep.
But at the time, it was just naturally just moved on. But then, you know, some of these stuck with us. Couple examples that I thought about. Alter Bridge, One Day Remains from 2004. It was their debut album. Members of Creed with a new vocalist, Miles Kennedy. Ooh. I heard it on the radio. I bought the CD. I looked in it, saw that it was Creed. Since I hated Creed so much, I felt like I couldn't like it, even though I did. So I actually returned it.
Wow.
And then in the years following, when the streaming services started, I was like, hey, I'm going to check that album out again. I'm like, man, I really did like this. I don't know. It wasn't because of anyone else. It was just because I had this unreasonable distaste for Creed, which I have since shed as well. Also, Harry Connick Jr., When Harry Met Sally soundtrack from 1989. I loved it when I was like middle school, high school, you know, jazz-infused, romantic standards. Like, it had to be you and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. But that's how you get the ladies.
No. That's why I didn't talk about it. I wanted to pretend I was cool and be into Bobby Brown or whatever. How about you?
Some point, I think, in middle school, I started exploring my parents' record collection. So I remember finding this Elvis compilation. Turns out it was like a mail order one, you know, really cheap, you know, compilation, but it had a lot of the hits. So yeah, I spent a lot of time listening to this Elvis record. I'm totally cool with it now, but it would have seemed pretty lame, I think, to my friends at the time. And another one I thought of from the 80s that stayed in my cassette collection for a while was Survivor, Vital Signs. Do you remember that album? Oh, yeah. Had The Search Is Over and High on You and stuff like that. It was the one after Eye of the Tiger.
Oh, yeah. After Eye of the Tiger. They got a new singer.
Yep. Again, I don't feel any shame about it now, but the time, you know.
Yeah. It's like if you had it in your Walkman and someone was like, what you listening to? You'd be like, and make something up. Be like, whatever was cool. Guns N' Roses. Yeah. All right. Well, the picks are in. Our hearts are pounding. Time to face our crushes head on. Let's get to our cha-cha-cha choices.
You choose me?
All right, so my secret crush is an album from the Goo Goo Dolls, their 1998 release, Dizzy Up the Girl. I'm not sure exactly why it was a secret crush. I guess it just, I don't know, because it was so popular and so kind of lightweight and accessible that I felt a little shame in liking it.
It wasn't cutting edge. I remember at the time telling people that pretending that I thought the Goo Goo Dolls were on the Lilith Fair tour because they were for girls.
So mean.
It was, again, unreasonable and stupid.
Yeah. So the Goo Goo Dolls were formed in Buffalo, New York in 1986 with guitarist and vocalist John Resnick. I think you used to call him Johnny Goo.
Yep. That would be a cool performing name.
Robbie, is it Taycock? Taycock.
I think Taycack, I Taycack. Think.
Robbie Taycack on bass and vocals. Originally, they had George Takuska on drums, but by this time, it was Mike Malinin. They originally were a pretty kind of heavier, sort of punky metal band, very influenced by bands like The Replacements, I think. But this album, Dizzy Up the Girl, is the follow-up to A Boy Named Goo, which had a hit song called Name that really brought them to mainstream success, and they start exploring this more, I guess, pop-based songwriting. Well, here's the opening track from the album, Dizzy Up the Girl. This is Dizzy.
That's pretty punk.
Yeah, it is.
Slowed down.
Yeah, there's a lot of relics or a lot of hints at their past in this. You know, they haven't completely shed it, but they're, you know, being more careful about presenting it.
Well, they found a thing called melody.
Yeah.
When they decided they could do that, it completely changed their trajectory.
Yeah.
And they had been at it at this point for a long time.
Yeah. Once you discover that you can write hit songs, like, why not do it? And that must be amazing. Like, oh my God, I can write a hit. Let's try to do more. So Dizzy was written by Johnny Resnick. Yeah, I would say one of the more kind of almost like a post-grunge sound on that song. You know, very simple, you know, straightforward rock song. Nice little hook in the middle. Nice chorus. You know, I guess it is a fan favorite when the people like to, the goo heads like to hear live.
It starts off like a hard rock song. Mm-hmm. So I'd never listened to this album before this. Mm-hmm. Of course, I know a lot of the songs, hits from it. And it starts up, ding, 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 ding. I'm like, yeah. And then almost like 5 seconds in, la, la, la. I'm like, okay, that's fine. But
yeah.
Kind of tricked me.
But they're giving you a kind of a melodic chorus.
It's like a combo, yeah. A combo deal.
Yeah. You know? It does remind me of the more accessible Replacements tracks.
I mean, it does kick off the album with a clear sort of planting a flag of, we are arena ready power pop now. Mm. This is who we are. Make fun of us if you want to. Those of you who think we've sold out, see in the rear view, because we got a whole bunch of new fans, so who cares?
Yeah, I agree with that. This next one here, Black Balloon, is the one that drew me into this record, because I wasn't interested in Iris, which was like the big kind of power ballad thing that was on the City of Angels soundtrack, which actually drove, I think, most of the early sales of this album. But yeah, here's Black Balloon. So this was another one written by Resnick, about a woman struggling with heroin addiction and the lover trying to save her. Supposedly inspired by Taycock. What's his name? Taycock?
Taycock.
Supposedly inspired by
Just use Taycock, his first name.
By Robbie's ex-wife, who actually died of a heroin overdose, sadly.
Yeah.
But yeah, this song has kind of a melancholy vibe. It's very melodic, so that's something that draws me in. Little darkness to it.
Well, that bing bing bong bing bing, that guitar thing is kind of cool. That,
yeah, I think it's harmonics. Yeah,
I was thinking this. I remember thinking this song was aight at the time. I never hated them. I just didn't make any time for them.
Yeah.
So yeah, watching someone self-destruct. I like that black balloon as a symbol. I mean, not just of addiction, but just of, you know, balloons are joyful and fun. A black balloon is like, stuff's kind of messed up.
It's ominous.
The string arrangements and the cinematic depth that they started to bring to these songs, that's really the biggest change in direction. But yeah, a song about trying to save someone who doesn't want to be saved. And that's a tough thing to deal with. So yeah, I think they handled the subject matter well, and the song supports, you know, the mood of what they're trying to get across. So So this was the song that drew you in. Like, did you have the album?
So I worked at the record store at the time, and so we used to get promo copies of albums.
Yeah,
so
free copies.
Yeah, so I think I took it because of this song.
Did you tell anyone?
Maybe, probably not.
That was the secret right there.
Yeah, it was the...
I mean, we were roommates around this time, right. A little after this time.
Yeah, you never noticed it in my collection?
It probably was hidden somewhere, maybe under your mattress or something.
I think a bit of a sucker for the jangly pop, guitar pop, you know, which this song and a lot of them actually on this record have that. But also the strings are pretty powerful. There's a heartbreaker on it, Benmont Tench. Remember him, the keyboardist from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers?
I mean, yes, just because of his awesome name. You're doing better with that than Robbie.
Right. All right, dude, was there a track you wanted to highlight?
I thought it was important that we gave Robbie some time. He's the bass player, but also sings on a lot of songs and was the original lead singer on their first album, their second album. Johnny started getting involved, then he kind of took over on the third and moving forward. But this one's called January Friend. Some Soul Asylum vibes. Yeah. I mean, I think the songs that Robbie is a singer on are the more rock songs. Mm-hmm. And Johnny Goo there kind of has taken over the role of encapsulating the hits and the more soaring sort of introspective songs. These are more jangly rock.
That's a good call with the Soul Asylum. I could picture them singing that song.
Yeah, cause it kind of hit this track in particular bridges the Goo Goo Dolls punk roots with their pop rock sound that they've by this point developed. Lyrically, it's a cryptic message to a companion evoking disconnection, transience, you know, which I think is like the sort of rock and roll lifestyle, the touring band stuff. But it's got overdriven guitars and snare heavy drums and more raw vocal. Yeah, it does, you know, harken back to some of their older stuff, which I appreciate. I think is necessary on a record like this that is so melodic and big to have these moments that are just pure rock fun.
Yeah, I do think his vocals probably hold him back a little bit. You know, I don't, if he was going to be the lead singer, I don't think, you know, they were ever going to have major hits.
Wow.
There were a at times I thought of Eric Cartman from South Park.
Screw you guys, I'm going home.
Yeah, you know, I think it's cool to, you know, still give him, you know, a few cuts on the album. I think it's a good song.
I think he took the cuts.
Well, okay, that's fine.
He wasn't given them. Like, oh, I'll throw you a bone because I'm Johnny Goo.
I don't know, I do. I've always been kind of curious about how that dynamic goes. You know, if there is bitterness and
they've been buddies for so long. Yeah. 1986. I mean, and by this point they were in their early 30s. Mm-hmm. You know, so if they made it through all that stuff and got to the, you know, becoming the toast of the town in Buffalo, nothing can break them.
Okay, well, let's hit the closing cut of the album. Here's one called "Hate This Place."
Was that a single?
I don't think so, but
it sounded familiar to me.
I do feel like there are about 10 singles off of this album.
Yeah,
I do love that hook there, though. The "Hold On, Dream Away, You're My Sweet Charade." It's nice. That one stayed in my head a lot this week. Still has sort of those punk roots, but yeah, definitely throwing in a lot of melody there. And I like when, you know, Johnny sings kind of in the upper register there. He still maintains a little edge in his voice. I guess it's the rasp that helps.
So the themes here, I guess, are like love and loss, disillusionment. Is that accurate to what you heard as well?
I think so. Yeah.
Supposedly it was a letter from someone stuck in a failing relationship, torn between leaving and holding on. Desperation, exhaustion, all that comes with a relationship that's crumbling.
I hate this place.
the place we're in. It's, you know, mm-hmm. there's a whole lot of you could take from that, I guess. It's the sound of closure, right?
Sure. I mean,
the song is about closure. It's the closing track on the album, and the album is seems like kind of a, especially the John Resnick songs, tour through love and relationships largely. So I think it's a good closer.
Yeah, I agree.
It works.
I really like the opening and closing cuts. They have a similar vibe. This one feels a bit more melancholy, you know, than the first one. It's not meant to be a concept album, I don't think. But you're right; it is kind of a journey through, I guess, you know, lost love, and what'd you say, disillusionment.
Yeah,
and then I think the Robbie tunes are maybe more that rock and roll lifestyle thrown in or something. He seems to sing more of that kind of, about that kind of thing. All right. It's a good time to rewind and reflect on Dizzy Up the Girl. I'll start with my clickbait headline. What you hear is what you want, and what you want are infectious rock melodies. I guess I'll sing it. That's a line from Slide, which we haven't talked about yet. What you hear is what you want, and what you want are infectious rock melodies.
Yeah. Wow, that did not help. Oh, what you hear is what you want, and what you... Okay, I got it now. I
want to get married. Yes. Okay. I don't know. I mean, they found their stride here. You know, they're writing what people want, and you know, there's no shame in that. I mean, they're good
writing
at it.
What they want.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's I don't have any problem with writing songs that people want to hear, because that's kind of the idea. What's the point otherwise? Right. And then yeah, and I mean, I think it does take some courage to step away from, you know, the punk rock thing. They probably alienated so many fans by going in this direction.
Yep. My overall vibe from the album can be summed up in a clickbait headline. They grew out of their mohawks and tuned their guitars. Dizzy Up the Girl is the punk kids pop album that actually doesn't suck. That's about my mission statement here. It doesn't suck. The songs are infectious. The hits in particular are hard not to sing along with. And it's got a blend of the punk grit mm-hmm. that they started with a little bit, with an adult alternative polish. And it's cinematic. It's a coming of age album. These guys had, you know, at this point in their career, they were grown up as well, just as much as rock stars can be. So yeah, it works. It was overall good. You know,
it's good.
I would. It's not like I don't think it didn't blow my mind, but it's good. Right.
Yeah, I agree with that. Killer to Filler. Well, I mean, there's huge hit songs. I mean, Slide was I think the first single. Well, technically, Iris was the first single. That was recorded for the City of Angels soundtrack. I think it came out in spring of that year, and then the album came out in the fall. But it was, yeah. Yeah. So that is the record that really drove sales of this album initially. But then the song Slide, which is another kind of jangly song, I think supposedly about a couple, I think a girl gets pregnant, like a teen, and they're, you know, deciding, you know, how to deal with it. And
that makes sense.
Yeah. So that's a great song. One of my favorites is Acoustic Number 3. Which is just this little quiet thing thrown in there. He's got his kind of romantic voice going in that one. And your father loves your mother.
So that's when that crush came on. You started getting sweaty.
Yeah.
Slipped a note into Johnny's locker.
Do you have any favorite cuts?
One that gets stuck in my head and annoyed the hell out of me, even back in the day when this album was out, Broadway. Mm-hmm. It's a mid-tempo song. I assumed it was like some reference to Broadway in New York and like musicals and stuff. Broadway is dark tonight. Like somehow I just like, bleh. Broadway sucks. Musicals suck. Goo Goo Dolls suck. But it haunts me, especially listening to this record. It came back. Like, it came back haunting me as it did 20 plus years ago. But it apparently draws on memories of growing up in the rough Buffalo neighborhood. And I guess Broadway was a street that it bisected the good part of town and bad part of town or something like that.
It's kind of dark. He's like the waiting for his turn to die. Or is it the young man drinking at the old man's bar waiting for the...
We're waiting for his time to die. Yeah, it's a good song. I've come around on that one. I liked Bulletproof. That was a Resnick song.
Yep.
More of a Boy Like Goo vibe. It felt more like that record, but I liked that one. You know, back to Iris, the one thing I found out that I thought was interesting was it was he was inspired by the Nicolas Cage character. This angel is willing to give up immortality for love, you know, mm-hmm. to be with this woman. I've never seen the movie, but that's kind of, he pretty much was like, well, I'm going to write this. I don't care if it sucks. I'll submit it. And yeah. then everyone loved it. And then they kind of found their direction. Filler wise, unfortunately, Robbie is the recipient of some of the, it's not his fault. It's just, they don't quite fit because they had changed their sound. And mm-hmm. I thought Full Forever was okay, but Extra Pale, I did not care for.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess you could look at them as a nice change of pace on the record, just to, you know, give it some edge. But yeah, you know, they're, when you're just comparing tracks, you know, they don't stand out.
I like them being peppered in, but I felt like there was one too many probably mm-hmm. of that style.
Yeah,
but agree with that. Again, I'm not a huge fan. I'm sure the fans, especially longtime fans, probably really enjoyed those tracks.
Yeah. So the production is provided by Rob Cavallo. His biggest claim to fame is the Green Day records. So he did Dookie. I think he did most of them, including American Idiot. I mean, I guess you never know to what extent the producer is influencing things, but, you know, it does seem to be a knack for arrangements, you know, so somehow balancing, you know, that rock grit with, I don't know, being able to hear the instruments, the separation in the sounds, and having a radio polish.
Yeah. Layered guitars. Mm-hmm. I think the operative word here is clean.
Yes.
Prominent vocals. The string arrangements on Iris and Black Balloon add emotional depth. They don't feel pandery. They feel like they help build the songs. Yep. So every element helped to serve the melody, especially through those more pop rock tunes.
All right. Well, replay value. Is this something you'll listen to again?
I won't avoid it. If I'm in the mood, I will, but yeah. I've avoided it for a long time. I might dig in a little bit more to some of the stuff they've done since, mm-hmm. just to see where the muse has taken them. But
now Robbie only gets one song, probably.
Poor Robbie. But, you know, on a drive or something, sure.
Sure. Maybe next time you visit Western New York.
Yeah. I'll be blasting it while I'll drive through Buffalo so that everyone thinks I'm cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is still, I mean, I'm no longer hiding it. You know, I do like yeah. this album. So I'm comfortable in my Goo Goo Doll. It's not an infatuation. I don't know what it is. It's a
appreciation.
Yes. Appreciation. There we go. All right. And then Legacy. I feel like, so in the late 90s and early 2000s, and this is coming from like the radio programmer perspective, but you had this hot adult contemporary format, you know, that popped up around the country. And I feel like this sound was it, you know? And so you had this rock music that was very accessible, still lighter than like the butt rock that comes a couple of years later. But I mean, you remember like the Fastballs and the Matchbox 20s and the...
Yeah, there's a lot of these.
Yeah. And so this is, I think the success of this album probably paved the way for that format's run.
Yeah. And it's an emotional honesty, I think, that appealed to people that were starting to grow up. People from that generation were also hitting their 30s and having families and wanting to connect on this level, you know. To songs. So yeah, I'd say it's a pretty decent legacy they built for themselves here.
All right. Well, the Goo Goo Dolls' Dizzy Up the Girl blends heartfelt songwriting and polished production, making it a pop rock touchstone that continues to resonate across generations. Check it out.
Excuse me. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
It's time again for Deep Questions. By Don. All right, we're going to get very personal this time. All right, so we've just been talking about our, I guess, musical crushes. Mm-hmm. But what about your, I guess, real romantic crushes? Let's just focus on childhood. Did you have any, you know, major crushes growing up?
Tons.
Yeah.
Constant. Starting at about age 4. babysitters, ladies on TV, movies, whatever, like pretty much always. probably one of my earliest was on my babysitter, Cheryl.
Ooh. Hello, Cheryl.
She would bring like toy, like she had this horse and like a Lone Ranger guy that would go on. It was like Barbie doll size. She was probably like 15. And she would bring that over for me to play with, and I would make excuses to sit on her lap and pretend I had hurt my foot or something. Get nestled in, you know what I mean? So, yeah, and then moving into kindergarten and first grade and stuff, getting into fights with classmates over a girl and, you know, Shannon in kindergarten, Raquel in first grade. Wow. And the list goes on and on. How about you, man?
Yeah, you know, I had the same kind of thing going on. But I was thinking about some of the, you know, like the TV and film crushes I had. Mm-hmm. You know, for people our age, I mean, Princess Leia's got to be a big one, particularly after Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, I know. Everyone talks about the stupid bikini thing, but
you were more like the cinnamon rolls on her on her ears. Or the
yeah, the bikini was better than the cinnamon roll hair.
I guess this one's a bit obscure. Remember Charles in Charge?
Yep.
So the first family that he was with, maybe, you know, some people aren't aware that there were two different Charles in Charge families. The first family, actually, it wasn't a family member. His girlfriend at the time, or love interest, I think her name was Gwendolyn.
Gwendolyn Pierce.
Yeah. So, yes. Blonde girl. I remember really liking her.
She's also in Ghostbusters briefly at the beginning when Peter Venkman is doing tests on the college students. She's answering all the questions wrong, and he's saying she got them right, and the other kid, this guy, is answering them right, and he's shocking him anyway. That same actress.
God, I love that movie. All right, well, what are your childhood crushes? Let us know on social media, like Instagram and Facebook, at Album Nerds.
So my secret album crush is more embarrassing than Don's, by far. It's Color Me Bad from Oklahoma City.
B-A-D-D.
Part of the sort of run of New Jack Swing bands, artists, groups in the late 80s, early 90s. Sort of a more doo-woppy version of Belle Biv DeVoe. Mm-hmm. But Color Me Bad was formed in the mid-80s by Brian Abrams, Mark Calderon, Sam Waters, and Kevin Thornton, doing a cappella performances. I guess they sang in front of record label studios waiting for people to walk by and discover them. Eventually, it worked.
Yeah, it sounded like they were cornering people after their show, like Bon Jovi and people like that. Yeah. Like, hey, we're going to sing for you.
Yeah, Bon Jovi let them open for them or something because of doing that. But their style blended New Jack Swing, R&B, and pop with a lot of doo-wop stuff. There's a little bit of rap on here I think the producers provide. Visually, they adopted that really flashy 90s fashion, that very Vanilla Icy look, solidifying their sort of boy band meets urban R&B image. At the time, I believed that they had been put together as a studio group, but they weren't. They are a naturally formed group. Yeah. So the album is CMB, which I believe stands for Color Me Bad, produced by R&B and pop producers like Dr. Freeze and Howie T, blending those vocal harmonies with drum machines, synth production, slow jams, upbeat New Jack grooves. And the album peaked at number 3 on the Billboard 200. The first hit was actually on the soundtrack to a movie called New Jack City. Let's listen to a little bit of I Wanna Sex You Up. That's really weird to say out loud. I got this album because of this song. It was on the radio all the time. I thought it sounded naughty. And the cassette club that I had joined, probably illegally because I was like 14 or something. Yeah. I got this album from there. I probably wouldn't have been allowed to have it because of the dirty sex song. But this was their breakout hit. It was produced by Dr. Freeze, who also did work with Belle Biv DeVoe. As I said, it was from that New Jack City soundtrack, which, you know, the album CMB, short for Color Me Bad, in the movie, the bad guy's gang is called CMB, standing for Cash Money Brothers. I think it's a coincidence. But it couldn't have hurt.
Yeah.
The song is a seductive invitation, wrapped in smooth harmonies, playful innuendo. Not great lyrics. I mean, what's embarrassing about this is it is corny, but it's catchy. Catchy as hell. All the songs, the singing is great. The harmonies are great. The vibe is good. What were your thoughts on what this song is called? Because I don't want to say that to your face as I'm looking in your eyes over Zoom.
It's, I think I had read that maybe a couple of the other New Jack Swing groups had passed on it, and you know, before it was given to Color Me Bad. And I was thinking of the lyrics. You know, it's a lot of it's innuendo, right? It's not as explicit as something Belle Biv DeVoe would normally do. I mean, they were you know, doomy and all that stuff. So I wonder if they passed on it because it just wasn't dirty enough.
I'm surprised they didn't change this to "I Want to Make Some Love."
Yeah,
clean it up a little bit. But saying sex even then, like on a song, was in 1991. I know it seems crazy that that was ever in our lifetime, like something like that was so naughty. But they wrote some, they were involved in the writing on some of the songs, but not this one. Another big one off of this has a really weird sound to it for the time, and it worked somehow. This one's called All for Love.
Yeah.
This represents the lighter, more pop-oriented side of the New Jack Swing era. Harmony-driven, it's a love anthem, co-written and produced by Elliot Strait, also known as Dr. Freeze and Howie T. That bing, 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 bing thing. I don't know what that is, but
It's a really weird song. I mean, it really stands out from the rest of the music at that time. I was pumping gas the other day, and this came on like the...
randomly?
Yeah, and... I was grooving to it. It makes me smile, the song. I don't know.
Yeah. That's the thing. I mean, there's something in listening to this record, and I've listened to it occasionally over the years. I don't have the cassette anymore. I got rid of it so none of my friends would see once I turned into the grunge man a couple, you know, about a year later. All my New Jack Swing hit the garbage can because I didn't want anyone to know.
You didn't put it in a time capsule?
I should have. Yeah, it's just so, it's just fun. It's just harmless fun, and they're, like I said, the singing is great, and it's hard not to, especially from a kid from that era, connecting to that time in my life when, like, I would dance in my room to these songs and do the moves that they did on TV, like a, you know, maniac. But those guys just, like, alternated really well between each other.
There's a, maybe there's a slight reggae vibe to it or something. Cause, yeah, cause I was actually thinking a little bit of like UB40, like something that they could do. I mean, that's really the standout cut on the album for me, I think.
The programmed drums and that syncopated hi-hat groove and sampled funk breaks, most notably from Lynn Collins' Think About It, which was written and produced by James Brown. So, they did some sampling here as well. Mm-hmm. But so, Don, what was a standout for you on CMB?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the other really big single from the album is I Adore Mi Amor.
I think I'm gonna have to stay forever.
That bass, bow, 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 bow. Yeah, this is just fun production. These are all simple arrangements, but they found some interesting support for their voices.
Yeah, I think the boys get songwriting credits on this particular track. And I think somebody had told them to kind of embrace their multiculturalism, you know, so to write a song that had both English and Spanish lyrics.
Yeah, I didn't really think about it at the time that they were just cool.
They were all from heaven, I think, right?
They were one of the first of these groups, I think, to be multicultural. All for One came later, and they were a nerdier version of this somehow.
Yeah, it's... There's so many parallels between like this and what came later with the boy bands of like Backstreet Boys and
Between a Boys to Men and stuff, when that this doo-wop stuff here became more forefront and then less New Jack on the subsequent albums. Mark Calderon is the one that does some Spanish-speaking lyrics in this one, which is...
He's the George Michael-looking guy?
He looks a lot like a shorter George Michael.
I'd have trouble looking him in the eye. I just feel like I'd get lost.
I remember singing along. I mean, I was taking Spanish in school, but I just remember singing along to the end of his part. It's like, contigo será verdad. I don't know. I thought I was cool doing that. I remember looking in the tiny liner notes in the cassette, singing along to the Spanish part. This is why it was secret, people. It all comes out now.
I picture you doing it in Spanish class or something.
No, but I mean, in my room, though, I'm sure like I was, you know, hand out emoting fully. Because, you know, thinking about girls and crushes and like these songs were all about romance stuff. And at the heart of it, teenagers are obsessed with that.
Yeah. And there is more of an innocence to this than I think the Boys to Men later. Like, it was much more, I guess, overt, the sexuality of the other ones, or the, I guess, just lyrically, you know, there was less, more direct, I guess, is the.
Yeah. That's what happened over the years. Yeah. I mean, now we're at a point where people just say it straight out. All right. So the album closes with a song that I don't remember listening to. I mean, I know it was on there, but I probably was rewinding to the hits. Yeah. This is called You're the One I Wanna Love, with a really uncool spelling that I think was supposed to be very cool.
Yeah. When I first saw it, I'm like, what is it? Onina? I know it's Onena Live.
Let's check it out. This is one of the attempts to be a little more hip-hop.
Yeah.
There are a handful of these on the album. It doesn't fully work. It isn't quite hip-hop enough.
Yeah.
Maybe if they've gotten a name rapper on there. I remember kind of ignoring this song. I don't think it's the best closer. Personally, I would have closed it with the track that comes before this. It's called Color Me Bad, and it's not a great song, but it's fun. It's basically kind of over the beat of Play That Funky Music by Wild Cherry, but it's just them talking about who they are, their producer. There's some name dropping. It's just some fun back and forth, and I think that would have been a more fun way to end it, with like, here's who we are, now rewind the tape and listen again, you know?
I would say the album does not end with a bang, and it, just overall, like, you know, by the time you're done, it's time to be done, I think.
Making love until we drown. Yeah, I agree. By this point, it kind of wears out its welcome because the hits are gone. Mm-hmm. Okay, so why don't we take the time to rewind and reflect on CMB. I'll kick it off with my overall vibe, represented by my clickbait headline. This glossy early 90s pop R&B album is pure new jack swing energy, and I can't quit it.
I wish I knew how to quit you.
It still gets me in that spot. Whatever new jack swing brought out of me, because I was a big fan of that era and that music at that time, and trying to harmonize with my friends on the school bus and all that stupid shit. It's just really nostalgic for me, I guess. And I guess that's where the crush continues, even though it's sort of embarrassing. As much as I want to hate it, it's still a part of me.
Well, my clickbait headline is, don't color it bad. It's exactly what it should be. It's pretty good. Yeah, I enjoyed listening to this. It was fun. I mean, I enjoy their vocal talents, and I appreciate that short-lived New Jack Swing era, which I think it may have hurt them moving forward, you know.
I mean, only a couple of years later they came out with Time and Chance, and by then West Coast rap had come in, gangster rap and all those things, and New Jack Swing was quickly dying on the vine, and there was no place for them. They went from multi-platinum to like a joke overnight, much like Vanilla Ice and MC Hammer and even the bigger ones, Bobby Brown and Bell Biv DeVoe. They all sort of backed into the behind the curtain again.
It makes me sad because, I mean, there's no reason a vocal group like this couldn't have just kept making records and, you know, that were nice and fun. And
MTV had moved on, too. And at that time, they decided. Any killers, fillers for you?
Well, I think the biggest killer, I think, is All for Love, just because it's such an interesting sounding song.
Yeah.
So we already talked about that. Another video I think I remember was Thinking Back.
That's a good song.
Yeah, I like that one. That's one of my favorites. And I think we're probably going to disagree on the interludes.
Yeah. Right?
So they end up kind of revisiting I Want to Sex You Up and I Adore Mia Moore.
Yeah, briefly.
Yeah. I don't know if, is it just to say to the listener, hey, you know, are you still listening?
Yeah. That's kind of how it felt like. So I was a listener of this at the time and playing that tape. Tapes were a little harder to navigate than even vinyl records to get from song to song. And when those would come on, it's like, cool, they're playing the song again. It's like, oh, it's just part of it. And then, because that's what I was really there for. Mm-hmm. I was there for the hits.
I like it sometimes when there's a reprise of a song on an album because it's usually part of like a concept or something. But this is not a concept album, I don't think.
No, it just goes to show, though, they knew what the strong songs were.
Yeah.
And in this era, name of the game was hit, hit, hit. And I feel like they didn't write enough hits.
Yeah.
That's where they missed. They needed two more. And I think that they potentially could have had a longer career if they'd had a couple more. And I think, you know, Roll the Dice was one that could have. It's kind of more funky.
Yeah.
It's in the middle. They use gambling metaphors to describe the risks of love. And it's a little more adventurous than some of the other songs as well, sonically. And Slow Motion, which I think was a single, but this is a more sensual R&B track. It's a little simpler. Yeah. And I'm surprised that one didn't take off a little more, but Heartbreaker and Groove My Mind were a couple that I could have done without for sure. And it's a quick album, you know, and it's of its time and it's fun regardless of the fillers or whatever. It's just a fun listen. Mm-hmm. Production wise, Howie T and Dr. Freeze helped bring some radio ready, crisp drum machines, shimmering synths, and then blending that doo-wop in with the new Jack Swing, I think is what they did well. And managed to kind of cut a new path in the new Jack Swing sound.
Yeah, and they do some interesting trickery there on I Want to Sex You Up. The TikTok You Don't Stop is very prominent in one channel and then moves over to the to the other channel. Very very dramatic.
So replayability, I think I've basically said yes. It's fun, nostalgic, genuinely enjoyable R&B time capsule. I say yes.
I remember maybe it was like MTV Music Awards, Color Me Bad and Boyz II Men were kind of like going back and forth, like dueling vocals or something. So like I was thinking, would I rather listen to this record or to that Boyz II Men record? I would assume that the Boyz II Men record might be better, but I feel like it would be kind of hard work or something to listen to. Like, this is just so fun.
This is cotton candy.
Yeah.
Like, you eat it fast, it dissolves. Right.
It gets sickening after a while.
And then you want another one later. Legacy-wise, I don't really think there is much other than it epitomizes that early 90s crossover pop R&B sound. Like the picture of Color Me Bad could be in the Webster's dictionary for this era.
Yeah. And I mean, I suppose they were kind of a prototype for what some of those, you know, boy bands were later. You know, very much the model that brought us into the late 90s and early 2000s.
So from slick new jack grooves to heartfelt ballads, CMB captures a moment in early 90s R&B that still makes you want to dance, swoon, and sing along. TikTok, You Don't Stop. Check it out.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Okay, so this week we've been listening to our old crushes. Do you have any new crushes? What are you digging this week?
Well, because of the CMB album, I was mostly making love until I drown, but it's such a weird line, but somehow it works. I don't know. Anyway, I stumbled across a new country artist named Carter Faith. The album is Cherry Valley. This is her first full length. I guess an EP came out in 2021 called Let Love Be Love. but she's an American country singer-songwriter from Davidson, North Carolina. Cherry Valley was released October 3rd, 2025. Let's listen to a little bit of sex, drugs, and country music. So the album features 15 tracks, including Sex, Drugs, and Country Music, Bar Star, and Betty, produced by Topher Brown. It blends traditional country music with cinematic storytelling, kind of inspired by artists maybe like Willie Nelson or Kacey Musgraves in particular. Mm-hmm. But there's supposedly a theme, an element where these songs are all tied together and that they go in chronological order. I've only listened to it like two or three times. It's not exactly a concept, but I guess there is a specific order to them that they encourage people to check out the whole album to uncover.
That's cool. I like the sex, drugs, and country music, you know, because,
yeah.
I mean, obviously that's usually associated with rock and roll, but I think the country music lifestyle is just as sex and drugs as rock and roll.
You know? More whiskey forward, perhaps.
Yeah, mix in a little church.
Yeah. So next up, a band that we haven't talked about on the show, and I hope we do at some point, America, and their debut album, America, which I have a bunch of their records, but I didn't have their debut. I picked that up recently at the record store for like $4 or $5. The band America formed in London in 1970 by Gary Beckley, Dewey Bunnell, and Dan Peake, all U.S. Air Force kids. They were sons of people in the Air Force. So they met overseas and started this band. Recorded in 1971, leans heavily on our acoustic guitars, vocal harmonies, soft folk pop sensibilities. So why don't we listen to a little bit of A Horse With No Name?
You see, I've been through the desert on a horse with no name.
I love this era in music, this 70s soft rock. Some great sort of unsung bands. Oh, yeah. I mean,
The percussion on that song is so interesting. I don't know what it's like pounding on, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's a good song, good album. It's a great discography. I encourage checking them out just in general. So what have you been digging there, Donny Boy?
Well, if you listen to the news at all or watch the news or read the news, it's kind of hard to avoid news that Taylor Swift came out with a new album. I was actually kind of marveling at probably how few artists there are where it would actually be a news story that that their new album dropped. But it's definitely true for Taylor Swift.
Well, and she's great about continually releasing new music.
Yeah. I mean, she must have hundreds and hundreds of songs in her catalog with how prolific she is. So the new album is called The Life of a Showgirl. Here's the opening cut, The Fate of Ophelia.
No songs called Travis or...
No, but supposedly one of the songs might reference his like sexual prowess. I'm not
the chief of my heart.
I might be. I haven't dug in too much on the album, but I figured I should check it out just because I don't know.
Yeah, I haven't gotten around to it yet.
It seemed like news. It does seem like it's a bit more straightforward pop. It's not quite as melancholy as the last album we listened to. It was called the Tortured Poets Department. Also, so this week, I'm going to have the pleasure of seeing Gary Numan live. We had talked about his album, The Pleasure Principle, a while back. So I've just been kind of going through his catalog. And one of my favorite albums is one called Telecon. It was actually the follow-up to the Pleasure Principle, released in 1980. It's part of what he called his machine phase. Mm. But here's a song called We Are Glass.
Yeah, that seems more of the time, like almost new wavy and less, here in my car, you know.
So this album in particular, Trent Reznor apparently was a fan, kind of inspired his work on Pretty Hate Machine. And then kind of ironically, Gary Numan has gone very Nine Inch Nails. So if you listen to any of his recent material, it's very kind of heavy industrial. So one of these days, I'll get to one of those records, I think.
Cool.
All right. So what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky at Album Nerds.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, here we are once again. It's time on the show when I'm reminded of the words of actor, writer, comedian. Not comedian. People don't say that anymore, thank God. That was an awkward thing to call female comedians. Mindy Kaling.
That's Kelly from The Office.
Yes. And she said, crushes are great until you realize you have to act on your feelings or forever eat lunch alone with your notebook.
That kind of sums up my my formative years.
I can see it. Now, being that it is early fall, heading into spooky Halloween season, we're going to be exploring, what are you supposed to be? You know, when you're trick-or-treating and the people at the door ask, what are you supposed to be? These are going to be bands and artists who are known to perform in masks, costumes, that kind of thing.
I'm Optimus Prime.
I was Optimus Prime the last year I trick-or-treated when I was 12. So yeah, we're going to focus on the theatrics of costuming and stuff to loosely tie in with the Halloween season. So that should be fun.
We can't do Kiss again, can we?
We can't do Kiss again. I would love to, but no.
All right. Who are your favorite artists that wear costumes or masks? What else are you listening to? Email us at podcast@albumnerds.com or follow us on Instagram and other social media at Album Nerds. And visit albumnerds.com to listen to all 310 episodes. And the best way to support the show is to share it. Please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app.
Thank you so much for joining us here on the Album Nerds Podcast. We'll catch you next week with those scary disguises.
Spin on, spin away. We'll talk records every day.
Wow, you're pushing. Why do you always pick the parts right up?
Day I explore. Me records.
I like it.
Me records.
Me records. See you next time, y'all.